Today, the story of how Los Angeles County became one of America's worst COVID hotspots.
I went to a outdoor funeral for the mother of Juliana Jimenez Sesma. It was in a parking lot of a church in South Los Angeles. It was a socially distant gathering. Attendees there wore face masks and plastic shields and kept distance from each other. There was a mariachi band that came and played a song and played a tribute, and everyone there wore masks the entire time, including the band members who were singing.
Sam Levin is a journalist for Guardian US, and for the past few weeks, he's been reporting on the pandemic in Los Angeles.
It was just a surreal and really sad scene, you know, and I saw people just wiping their eyes and crying under layers of masks and face shields, and Juliana, who had lost her mother and her stepfather, you know, was saying that they made sure not to hug each other and, you know, they made sure to keep separate from each other. And this family was very frightened, and so they wanted to do everything possible to be as safe as they could.
This funeral that Sam describes is sadly one of many that has taken place across Los Angeles County in recent weeks. A third of all COVID deaths there have happened since Christmas, leaving hospitals and funeral services struggling to cope. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, inside LA's COVID crisis. Sam, you've described that funeral in a car park and a woman, Juliana, who was laying her mother to rest. Who is she and what can you tell me about her and her family?
So Juliana Jimenez Sesma is a 41-year-old Los Angeles resident who lost both her mother and stepfather to COVID just 11 days apart in December. Her mother, Maria, was 66 years old, retired. Her stepfather, Alberto, was 54 years old and had worked as a handyman. They both had pre-existing illnesses that made them vulnerable. She had a lung condition, pulmonary fibrosis, and was already depending on oxygen before she got COVID. And he had both asthma and diabetes. And Juliana lived with her parents in the same household, and her brother and his family lived right next door.
My mother was a very strong woman. You know, life had already given her many punches. She was a very hardworking woman. She worked in different fields, I want to say. Her last job was that of the machine operator, but, you know, she did whatever she had to, a lot of labor, you know, whether it was cleaning, you know, selling clothes, just for different types of jobs to be able to maintain me and my brother. And my mom always taught me to be strong and to strive for a better future.
It sounds like a family who were very close, who are very close.
Yes, her family is extremely close. Like many families, they have gatherings, they spend time together. And at some point at the end of November, all of them got infected with COVID. It was more than 10 family members. At the moment that Los Angeles was experiencing its worst surge yet of the pandemic, it was really the start of a 2-month increase in cases that was exponential and catastrophic and devastating.
I remember my mom had worn this sweater, like cashmere type sweater. And she said that she felt like an allergic reaction, like something in her throat. So she had a little cough, and then she took some medication. It kind of went away. And on Sunday, Thanksgiving weekend, Alberto and my mom, my stepfather, they both started with a persisting cough. On Tuesday, I took them both each to their primary doctor. And they basically just were prescribed some cough syrup. But on Friday night, he told me, you know what, I can't. I feel short of breath and I feel my body weak, like I'm going to faint. Right. At that point, and then that's when we took him to the hospital.
Okay.
That was December 4th.
So once they both got sick and were having trouble breathing, she had no choice but to take her parents to Martin Luther King Jr. Community Hospital in South Los Angeles, close to her home. It all just happened really fast. Her mother passed away on December 19th, and her stepfather was intubated on December 15th, and he passed away on December 30th. And the hospitals are closed to visitors, so she couldn't be with either of them in their final days. Once they were admitted to the hospital, she never saw them again. It's just such an unimaginable and devastating situation for Juliana. And it's also an incredibly common story in Los Angeles right now for so many families.
From your conversations with Juliana, what have you found this has been like for her? What impact is this having on her?
One of the worst parts of the experience was that after her mother passed away, Juliana was able to go to the hospital and very briefly see her mother's body to say goodbye. But because of concerns around COVID, you know, she had to wear a gown and gloves and a mask, of course, to do that. She was in this room trying to say her goodbyes and, you know, tell her mother that she loved her.
I can't even describe the words of the feeling of seeing your mother's body there and not feeling comfortable, to feel restricted to hugging her or kissing her, and a wee sense of guilt not being able to kiss her without the mask because of any diseases. That it's just a terrible feeling, you know. Am I explaining myself correctly? Like, are you understanding how I'm,
yes,
what I'm trying to tell you?
Absolutely.
Like,
I know.
Having to restrict yourself. So it's just, it's pretty heavy.
You told us, Sam, that Juliana's parents were treated at Martin Luther King Hospital in South LA, and you went there recently as part of your reporting. What was that visit like? I mean, what can you tell us about the hospital?
So Martin Luther King Jr. Community Hospital is a 131-bed facility in South Los Angeles, which is one of the hardest-hit neighborhoods in the region. They're essentially the epicenter of the crisis in America right now. It's located in a poor neighborhood, primarily Latino and Black, and just 4% of the patients there have private health insurance. So in normal times, the surrounding community just has so much chronic illness compared to the rest of Los Angeles.
Rapid respond, room 326, bed green, 3 south, rapid respond. Room 326, bed B, 3 south. Rapid response, room 326, bed B, 3 south.
So I spent some time inside the hospital in the beginning of January, and this was when LA was at the peak of the worst phase of the crisis yet. And at that time, the hospital was treating nearly double the number of patients than its normal capacity. Dr. Elaine Batchelor, the CEO, said they just have been forced to do so much care with the same amount of resources.
So today, our 131-bed hospital has 225 inpatients.
Okay.
And 135 COVID patients.
Wow.
We are licensed for 20 ICU beds, and we have 40 ICU patients in the hospital right now.
So when I got there, on the outside, we walked through some of these large white tents, essentially field hospitals that they had set up in the parking lot for triage and intake. And there, patients who are suspected of having COVID are separated and assessed. They're lying in gurneys with these small curtain dividers between them. And then inside the hospital, it felt like they had repurposed every inch of the hospital into treatment spaces. So there's an old gift shop inside that had gurneys inside, just had this small sign on the door that said, you know, patient care in progress. And then in the ICU, I was really struck by the sight of just a row of patients back to back lying on gurneys inside a narrow hallway. You know, you have doctors rushing by in these enclosed air purifying helmets that look kind of like astronaut gear. And it's just so grim to think of these people fighting for their lives or being stuck in this hallway because that is the only place they can go.
What did the staff tell you about what it's like for them to work in this hospital at the moment?
I spoke to a nurse, Anais Correa, after my visit. She's the nurse manager for the intensive care unit. And she, you know, told me a bit about what this last surge has been like for her and for her staff.
We're seeing not as great outcomes because they are coming in sicker. So we are seeing what feels like a higher mortality. And I'm not too sure about the data, but it does feel like a higher mortality with the second surge. And so we've had a lot of deaths in the ICU. And it's been emotionally exhausting for the staff.
Is there anything else that you would want to share about this moment?
Honestly, I don't even know what to say anymore. Everybody says, you know, continue social distancing, continue wearing your mask. But I think at this point, it's the situation is so dire. So what we find the biggest challenge is when patients get admitted, families don't talk about what their wishes are. So if I were to not have capacity to make medical decisions for myself,
Yeah. This
is what I would want. 90% of the time, families will tell us, we don't know, we've never had that conversation. That's our biggest challenge in the ICU, is just have more of those conversations with your family. It's okay, we need to release the stigma from that.
Sam, why are so many people ending up in this hospital?
I talked about this with Dr. Elaine Batchelor, who's the head of this hospital, and she was saying that one of the biggest systemic problems with our healthcare system is that it's essentially a separate and unequal system. So people who don't have private health insurance don't have access to good healthcare in normal times. And so that means that the people who are requiring help now are coming in with so many serious illnesses that make it much, much harder to keep them alive. And there's just serious disparities in the kind of treatment that different communities in Los Angeles get.
We're located in a community that's vulnerable. Yeah. So these are the bus drivers. These are the people that stock the grocery shelves. They clean up. So they've continued to be exposed to COVID in the community. Before the COVID pandemic, we were seeing more patients in our emergency department than most hospitals. And the people that are coming in are people who have end stages and complications of treatable chronic illness. Amputations and wound care for diabetics are the number one surgical procedure we do at the hospital. Mm-hmm. So even before the pandemic, we were dealing with a community that was in its own little crisis.
Right.
And the patients that we see, the COVID patients are predominantly Latino.
Right.
80% of our COVID patients are Latino.
The situation became so dire at MLK Hospital that the CEO, Dr. Batchelor, sent an urgent letter to the California governor, Gavin Newsom, just before Christmas, requesting help and explaining how COVID was devastating her community in South LA and just overwhelming her staff and her facilities. And the governor, in response, sent 3 National Guard medical teams and extra nurses. But when I was there 2 weeks later, the situation was still very serious.
You described being at the funeral for Juliana's mother at the start of this interview, and I wondered how the high death toll in hospitals like Martin Luther King Jr. have impacted the funeral industry in the county.
So in recent weeks, we've seen just a total breakdown of the funeral industry in the entire region of Southern California. Basically, every part of the system is overwhelmed. One of the most grim illustrations of how dire this has become is that there's actually a backlog of more than 2,700 bodies stored at hospitals and coroner's offices. And because of that, local air quality regulators announced that the county had to actually lift the limits on the number of cremations that are allowed in the region. Cremations release toxic mercury emissions, and there's usually a cap on the number allowed. But because there are just so many bodies, they have to speed up the cremations.
That sounds incredibly grim. I mean, presumably, this backlog is then impacting funeral services that aren't happening.
It's impacting the whole process. And of course, it's grieving families who are suffering the consequences of this. So if you lose a family member to COVID right now during this horrible wave, it means you have to spend hours and hours calling funeral homes, you know, trying to find someone who will essentially take your loved one. And you'll be told that the mortuaries are full and they will be full for the foreseeable future. And if people are able to find a mortuary with the capacity to take on their loved one, or if they get on a waiting list, they're often told that they have to wait more than a month for a service. So it's just an awful situation for people who have already gone through something so, so traumatizing.
What was this like for Juliana? What did she tell you about her own experience of this?
It was extremely painful for Juliana to just have to wait and to deal with all of those really grim and horrifying logistics when the whole system is overrun. I think just made the entire process for her even more painful.
Did have other families' services ahead before of us. So almost 3 weeks that I had to wait to be able to have my mom's memorial, pain on top of pain, having to wait, you know. You don't get to be in peace or have a little more peace until you know that they're put to rest, their body, you know?
Coming up, why when cases are still so high, are parts of LA County starting to ease restrictions? Sam, you've been reporting on this for weeks. You've talked about why Martin Luther King Jr. Community Hospital is seeing such a high caseload. But why has the county been so badly hit?
One factor that makes Los Angeles uniquely vulnerable is that we have a severe housing crisis here. Most crucially, we have a huge problem with overcrowding. You have these large working class families and multi-generational households that are sometimes all sharing a one-bedroom apartment. You know, LA has one of the highest rates of overcrowded homes in America. So that means when one person brings the virus home, everyone falls sick.
Because of rising COVID cases in Los Angeles County, the message there is now to also mask up at home.
It will just add a layer of protection while we get through this surge and try to get our case numbers and our transmission way down.
It's interesting, isn't it? You talk about overcrowding, and I think for many of us in the UK, the Los Angeles we've often been shown is Hollywood, not poorer areas. Is this a crisis that has disproportionately affected different neighborhoods?
Yeah, the toll of the pandemic here is not equal. So proportionally, we've seen that Latinos are suffering the most. I think they're dying at a rate that is 2.5 times greater than white people. And Black Americans in Los Angeles are dying at a rate that is 1.5 times greater than white residents. So we've seen this pandemic just looks completely different depending on where you live.
Why do you think this has got so bad now?
One of the main factors is that there's a ton of fatigue with restrictions here. You know, Los Angeles and California more broadly has had some form of restrictions throughout this entire pandemic. And so I think people are kind of exhausted with that and people are giving up, you know, trying to be safe. And then combined with that, we've had the holidays, one after the other, I think from Halloween to Thanksgiving to Christmas to New Year's, just so many different family gatherings and social gatherings that probably should not have happened, but did.
What has the leadership from public officials been like?
Public officials have been begging people to stay home and wear masks and socially distance throughout the entire pandemic. But because the rules have changed so much and so frequently, I think that people have sort of stopped paying attention and they've stopped listening to those guidelines. And at the same time, you've had accusations of hypocrisy with public officials. Most famously, our governor, Gavin Newsom, was actually caught eating at this posh restaurant in Napa Valley.
Oh, no.
And that
doesn't look good at all.
No, I mean, I think that really was a turning point in his leadership here.
You can quibble about the guidelines, et cetera, but the spirit of what I'm preaching all the time was contradicted, and I got to own that. And so I want to apologize to you because I need to preach and practice, not just preach.
With this rise in cases, has the governor, Gavin Newsom, tightened restrictions? Are things changing?
We've gone back and forth throughout the entire pandemic. I think we've had three different rounds of the state doing statewide restrictions. But actually this week, you know, at the end of January, we've lifted the state restrictions, and Los Angeles is actually going to be removing some of its restrictions right now.
We are in a position projecting 4 weeks forward with a significant decline in the case rates, positivity rates. We are anticipating decline, still more decline in hospitalizations and more declines in ICUs. And that's why we're lifting that stay-at-home order effective immediately today.
The reason is that we're starting to finally trend in the right direction. That being said, the numbers are still astronomically high. And so I think some people are struggling to understand why we aren't keeping much stricter regulations in place.
$100 million shots in 100 days is not the end point. It's just the start. We're not stopping there. The end goal is to beat COVID-19.
Do you feel more optimistic now that Joe Biden is president and has a very different plan to tackle coronavirus than Donald Trump did?
I think there's a lot of hope here that this will be a turning point in the pandemic, especially when it comes to vaccines. But at the same time, the toll has already been so devastating that it feels like some of it might just be too late. You know, for so many families, it is too late.
Finally, Sam, you've been reporting on this tragedy, but you also very sadly experienced COVID in your own life after your grandmother, who lived in LA, contracted it and passed away. How has this affected the way you think about what is happening at the moment?
It's been really hard for me to go through this process myself while reporting on this. I mean, this is one of the most traumatic losses I've ever experienced. And, you know, I got a call about my grandmother being moved into the ICU right as I was heading to MLK Hospital to report inside of an ICU. And I think experiencing this personally has made clear to me just how prevalent the virus is in LA right now. It just feels like everyone here can't escape it. We're all sort of harmed by this catastrophe in one way or another. So I think there's just a lot of trauma on top of trauma for everyone in LA, whether it's reporters or essential workers or people going about their lives. And I think my grandma's passing, you know, sorry,
That's okay.
I've long felt like our country has been failing us in so many ways during this pandemic. And I think my grandma's passing really put that into sharp focus for me. You know, we should not have lost her, and her death absolutely feels like an indictment of our government and our healthcare system. You know, we did everything right throughout the pandemic. She did everything right throughout the pandemic, but it wasn't enough. And the fact that she lost her life after 9 months of being isolated and after 9 months of following all the rules, it just shouldn't have happened.
I think the thing that strikes me as being so difficult in all of this is trying to remember the people who are dying when there's so much death happening at the moment. What was your grandmother's name, Sam, and how will you be remembering her?
My grandma Debbie had overcome so much in her life. You know, she actually grew up an orphan. She was basically abandoned by her parents at age 3 and left at a nunnery and was raised by nuns without family, and overcame all of that to just build an incredible family and, you know, give a life to her children and to my mom that, you know, she never had as a kid. And, you know, she does leave behind an incredible legacy here. I'm just so, so beloved by her family and by the community in Long Beach. And I think we are all suffering through this horrible feeling that it was just too soon and it wasn't her time. She was 80 years old. She was healthy. You know, she had 2 decades left in her. I really believe that. You know, me and my brother who live in LA did everything we could to both keep her safe as well as keep her company. And so, you know, we would go to her house and have these outdoor, socially distanced, you know, backyard hangouts where we'd eat Chinese food and burritos and every other cuisine we could bring. And I feel so grateful and lucky to have that time with her. But, you know, we weren't able to have Christmas like we normally did. We weren't able to have Thanksgiving. You know, we didn't have any of those family gatherings because we were following the rules and we wanted to keep her safe. And ultimately, it wasn't enough. And that is so unfair and it just should not have happened.
So I'm so sorry for your and your family's loss. And thank you so much for speaking to me.
Thank you so much.
That was Sam Levin. You can read all of his reporting from Los Angeles, including a tribute to his grandmother, at theguardian.com, where you can also listen to an episode we made with him in December about an incarcerated firefighter called Boonchang Keola. And this is a story I'm very happy to be able to bring you an update on.
Hello, Sam.
Hi, Tong. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for picking up. Is Boone there as well?
He is here.
Good morning, Sam.
Hey, Boone.
So you may remember that Boone had served a 22-year sentence in a California prison and was due for release last year, but instead was sent to an immigration detention center where he was threatened with deportation to Laos, a country he left when he was 4. Last week, Boone was released and he's been reunited with his sister, Tong.
Words can't describe how, you know, I mean, I could say excitement and joyful and everything else, but like I said, no, but at the same time, I want to get started, man. I want to get on my feet and work and help people like myself and, you know, succeed. And that's it, I mean, right now. And, you know, I mean, of course, I'm going to spend time with my family. It feels good to even just be around them, but, you know, let alone hug them. And
I'm so happy to hear that. And I'm just so glad that you're all together. And Tong, how are you feeling just to actually be in the same room with Boone?
You know, just like he said, like words can't even describe, like giddy, you know, like it's, I feel complete. You know, my family is finally together and this big mountain has been removed from my shoulder. And, you know, every so often, you know, I look over like, he's really here. Let me go give him a hug. Like, my brother is finally back.
That's it for today. This episode was produced by Sammy Kent and sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.